Cardiff now appears to double for everything, according to the BBC. Everything must be made in Cardiff.
Well, it's that nice moment when you actually, you walk past the Millennium Centre, and now, instead of going, what a great tribute to the Millennium and to Welsh, and you go, Cat Hospital from Doctor Who, and you think, oh, that's childish. Hello, anyway, this is the Paramount podcast. I'm joined, as usual, by Josie Long, who
hello.
Also, as usual, is just halfway through eating an apple, and also
it's
by...
three quarters.
Oh, you three... Sorry, I'm very bad on apple geometry, and also joined by Stephen Merchant
hello.
Today. So I don't know what I don't even know what we've brought or what we're going to talk about. But I do like talking about basically places that don't look like they should do in films. I think is excellent. When you go to America, you go, wow, America looks like films.
It always looks exactly like films.
Yeah, New York. The first time you go to New York, you go, well, that looks like Midnight Cowboy. That could be the place where that scene in Kramer
versus
Kramer.
Yes, it is one giant movie set that you expect Godzilla to trample down, and it's remarkable.
All of the buildings, I had a day where I was just freaking out because I was just like, this must be a dream. This is exactly... Oh,
well, when you first visit Los Angeles, it does look as though it's a big movie set and that they're not real buildings and that you could push them over... and there'd be a couple of guys having a fag behind. There is that extraordinary artificiality about it. But yeah, there's something about London and even England. Why is it that it's sort of harder to make it look iconic and sort of magnificent? You know, New York just feels like, as you say, a place designed for the movies. But London's kind of, it's bitty and it's scrappy. And
what happens to me with London is if I go to a posh bit, which is far out of my realms of expectation, then I think, oh, Richard Curtis films, wherever I go.
Yes.
That's so... It does have that shorthand for me.
Now, where do you stand on the controversial subject of Curtis, you know, painting the sort of the Hollywood Disney version of England by which to sell England back to Americans? Is that controversial to you? A lot of people criticise Curtis. They say, we don't all live in stately homes. We don't all have weddings in, you know, giant, you know, country houses. And I say... So what?
Because my favourite thing that I would say in Love Actually, which I did get a little bit tetchy about, I do like the fact there'll be a lot of plots about perhaps quite an upper middle class Englishman. Maybe he's a poet, maybe he's a writer, I don't know. And he has a maid who doesn't speak the same language as him. But despite the division, at some point in the walk-in fridge, they meet and they clasp.
Yeah.
And then I love the fact that a lot of people criticise Notting Hill for going, well, where are the black characters? I mean, Notting Hill's, you know, it's ridiculous.
I'm one of the few people that that likes Love Actually.
I'm really glad that you said it, because me and my friend Alice on Christmas Day watched it and bawled like fucking children.
I mean, now the more I think about it...
It's designed to push your buttons. Yeah. And occasionally, sometimes, it's very nice to think this is a very sweet, stylized version of London that I could never possibly afford to inhabit.
But you see, that's sorry.
And they all... And, you know, and it's
and
so,
lots of sort of middle class... sort of aging middle class writers who are sort of inexplicably attractive to younger women. They're a film, of course, written by a aging middle-aged writer.
But that is the tradition. That's the great British tradition. It's like my favourite thing about On the Buses, and I don't like watching the TV series because I don't think it has the correct level of professionalism to which Hammer films did when they turned them into movies.
Sure.
And what I love is watching actors, many of whom are nearly 60,
yes.
with yellow snaggly teeth,
yeah.
right, who are not even, they're not even matinee idols who've kind of just been left in the soil
they are just grotty men.
Yeah, oh, there we are. Yeah. And then, yeah. And then for some...
No, they don't have haircuts. It's just their hair has grown to a position. And that's... The day they were filming it is where their hair had grown to.
Yeah, yeah. You'll be the one with the brill cream because you're a little bit slick. You're like matinee idol.
Exactly.
You're all a little bit goofy, long hair, aren't you? And then a lot of women turn up and if they're a little bit fat, and they're middle-aged. And then... But these clippies, I think they're called.
Clippies,
or something
yeah.
like that they have those mini skirts where you see the frills of their pants and they turn up and they go, oh, I'm 17. I'll tell you what I fancy. Yeah. A man who may well die of a heart attack during the act of sex and his top set just drop out on top of my breast.
There is a remarkable seediness to 70s comedies. The beginning of Holiday on the Buses, the last of the Holiday Buses.
My favourite, if I may say so.
Well, and it starts, pre-credits, it starts with them reversing a bus out of the depot and a sort of French woman is queuing for a ticket, and as she runs across to catch the bus before it leaves the depot, her blouse, nothing catches her blouse, it just falls open, revealing her breasts. Reg obviously can't believe his luck. He crashes the van, and they crashes the bus, it all collapses, it all falls down, everyone cries. Then it comes up, music starts, credits. But those were the days when you didn't need an excuse for a woman's clothes to fall off. It was fine. Women's clothes fall off sometimes.
Here is examination of it.
But what the extraordinary seediness of those films, like, I always think about the Confessions films. Because they obviously took the Carry On level of sort of seediness to another notch. And so there is some quite explicit nudity, some quite unpleasant
proper sex scenes.
But it's the idea that you went out in the 70s thinking, you know, I want to see some tits, but I also want to see Irene Handel.
Yeah.
Where can I find such a combination?
The first film, Irene Handel goes topless, was a disaster.
Exactly.
Because I hadn't realised they wanted a division between the two.
Yeah.
No, Irene Handel, the breasts over there.
And Handel, not together in the same scene. But yeah, and it's sort of that, just that, that you can have Nubile Women and Windsor Davis, and that this is ticking a number of boxes for British audiences in the 70s. And lest we forget, one of the most interesting pieces of trivia, I always think, that I believe it's 71, I think the first On the Buses film, made more money in England that year than the James Bond film, which made Reg Varney more popular than Sean Connery in the year ending 1971.
Oh no, it's Selwyn Froggitt, which is about the only sitcom I've seen from that period.
Bill Maynard.
It doesn't come across as a sitcom. It comes across as like a weird, rambling thing that doesn't have any laughter in it. And what happens is this man tries really hard to be a good man and everyone just goes, "We despise you, Selwyn." And that's the jokes. And he's in his 50s and he lives with his brother and his mum, which is just dirty. And
well, the sort of plays for the day of that time, it seems to me, if you removed the laughter audience from things like On the Buses and all those other things, they would just be really depressing,
like a sad,
dramatic
gritty
portraits of the horrid, you know, England that we lived in the 70s.
Because there was this episode and he spent the whole time trying to raise money to take them all on a coach holiday, and then he got mugged, or he was in a car accident and he nearly died, and then everyone's reaction was just like, "You are such a cunt, Selwyn Froggitt. We wish you'd never been born." And then that was the end.
The classic "You're such a cunt, Selwyn Froggitt" episode.
Why don't we have more sitcoms ending with someone in a full body cast?
Yes, true, yeah. With the arms outstretched, the poles that stretch between them.
Oh, and then as the credits fade out, a nurse comes over and then... arms and legs up.
Well, yeah, there should definitely be more... Everyone carrying on the action while the credits roll at the end. Do you think there's a... Because although we sort of mock it, I have a great affection for the sort of classic sitcom style. You know, I used to get a little excitement in the beginning of Fawlty Towers with the, you know, seeing what the words were on the misspelled words on the hotel sign. And, you know, and the audience laughter, I think, does bring a sort of warmth to it at the very best shows,
then,
and an affection.
If you think about League of Gentlemen, that's got the same kind of thing. It's got all the visual gags at the start. It's got all that detail. And I think it does have canned laughter as well.
It does have canned laughter. But I wonder if there's have we reached a point now, and I hold my hand up as being guilty, is this where we've sort of moved beyond that? Now, whenever you do any of those things, it seems like you're being ironic and postmodern and too clever. And could you just do the classic Morecambe and Wise sketch show now on mainstream TV without it having an edge, having a bit of darkness, having a bit of sarcasm? And
I think there are some things going in that direction again now. I mean, there is a kind of return to studio-based sitcoms. There was one that I did at the end of last year. Chris Ellison, who was on this show a while back, it's called Lab Rats, and it is just a silly, stupid sitcom where I got the chance to wear a great big wig and run around in purple leggings and fall over and jump through balsa wood doors, and in many ways possibly ruin what's left of my career.
Sure, looking forward to that enormously. When's it on?
I think it's on in May. About May or June, but it was great fun. Today, I didn't mean to talk about nostalgia, but one of the things that I brought with me was, because it's obviously show and tell, we like to show it, and I've got a copy of the TV Times that I actually bought. This is probably the most expensive copy of the TV Times. I bought £2.50. It's got Little and Large on the front, Little and Large aiming for a hit telly show. It's the two of them with kind of quite elongated flintlocks. And
what year is that from?
I think it's 1976. It's for the Yorkshire area, May the 14th to the 20th. And Beryl's Lot there, which I presume, that sounds like that was probably a sitcom. Beryl's Lot. Barbara Mitchell. Carmel McSharry was... I always love reading just the small descriptions that they have. So Magpie, for instance, Jenny and Mick present more fun and fascinating facts, plus news desk. So I'm onto that. Beryl's Lot by Kevin Laffin, Carmel McSharry, Barbara Mitchell, Tony Cornter and George Selway. Catherine's behaviour is beginning to worry Beryl and Tom. Is she telling the truth? Fi has her own theories. I don't know why. There's something that I find tremendously exciting about reading one-line plot.
Must be people who are very good at that and people who aren't. Like, that was probably from the year that Reg Peters was doing it. And Reg Peters, within the industry of writing those, is a
best
god. Yeah. Like, his ones people have little books as inspiration for future. Like, just listen to this description of Casualty, and then you'll understand.
See? But it's the idea that even now that could have kind of happily been lifted from a sitcom description nowadays.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that does anyone read them and think, oh, I can't miss this?
I don't really.
She's got her own suspicions. I'd love to find out what her suspicions are. Yeah.
Or reading it and going, this week sounds bullshit.
This just sounds the same old, same old. What's the Bionic Woman I noticed there?
Well, I'll tell you. Well, Paradise Island, I've just found that because that's actually got Bill Maynard in it and the late William Franklin, who's excellent. The Paradise Island by Brian Cook, Cook and Mortimer. I can't remember what else they did. Castaways, Cuthbert Fulworthy and the Reverend Alexander Goodwin hunt for a wild pig, which leads them to discover that their island has been previously inhabited. So it doesn't sound like a sitcom, does it? It actually sounds like an action-adventure thing, but I'm imagining...
Is that a sitcom? That sounds really intriguing. It sounds like an episode of Lost.
Produced by William G. Stewart. And then you wanted to know Bionic Woman, 7:30. That's Once a Thief. This is May the 20th, by the way, just if you're interested. Jamie is blackmailed into becoming a bank robber.
Ooh, Christ.
That's it. I only needed one line there. Sometimes you need two sentences. I'm not... Well, how the hell is that going to happen?
How's Jamie going to get out of that?
Well, she's going to use either some kind of bionic leg... or bionic ear, almost certainly. She's not going to just explain to the police there's been a mix-up and she's blackmailed.
Taking a folder of filings.
Exactly, yeah.
I'd just like to show you this letter.
So, yeah, Richard Whiteley on Calendar Sunday. Oh, can you keep talking? I'll find some other... this is great. Fall in the Stars. That's a good one. Fall in the Stars, which includes a guest appearance by brand new double act Coffee and Cream.
Oh.
Yeah, can you guess? No, never mind. And it's Fall in, all the stars are there, including Dennis Walter, Joan Turner, and Simone. My show and tell today is I found a selection in a kind of weird, grubby little secondhand bookshop, a load of magazines called things like Man's World, The Men Who Broke the Nazi Hooker Scandal, and they're all kind of badly illustrated. The cover of this Man's World is I Made Love in a Sex Research Lab. But they have these great adverts for jobs. They're just packed with different offers. The one that I forgot to bring in, which is a great advert, full-page advert going, make money and enjoy yourself in the meatpacking industry.
Wow.
Which, and it makes it look really good because you've got these men, they've got big buzzsaws and they're going through meat.
I was in Peckham Row at 4 a.m, I was waiting to get a bus home and I looked over the road and I saw three men at 4 a.m. unloading a frozen meat van and they had pig carcasses on their shoulders. They were having the most fun that I've ever seen people, they were laughing, they had like pig blood all over their faces.
Were they making the pigs talk like they were still alive? Like kind of
doing little playlets,
classic little playlets, just squeezing the heads over their own.
But they were really laughing and I thought, you're carrying three pig carcasses at 4 a.m. off a freezer into a halal butcher's on Peckham Row Lane and you're having such a lot.
Well, the twilight world of jobs, who knows what's going on, you know? I mean, there's all sorts of... I once passed in Coventry, I was there once and I passed again late at night, there was a door that was open and I just happened to... And there was you know, you'll sometimes get like a sort of glass atrium, like a glass door and then behind it another glass door on an office block or something, and there was a woman trapped inside between the two and she was sort of clamouring on the glass and I said I don't know, I can't help, I don't know, I don't want to get involved, I don't know what's going on, and I sort of moved on and there was a door that was opened and I peered inside and inside was a vast warehouse women sat at sewing machines, endless sewing machines, presumably, you know, some kind of illegal workforce making who knows what for who knows whom. And I thought, you know, obviously I could open the door and cut their shackles let them off, but again, it's probably safer just to scurry on. You know, I was a student and who knows who those women were, what they were making, are they still okay? You know, are you one of those women? What? Get in touch.
I think between about 3 and 7 a.m. people are much kinder to each other. It's a nice time. Actually, I used to in Edinburgh 2001 we lived up Leith Walk and there was this guy who worked in the all night garage there who was and he was there when we were walking back from like going out in Edinburgh, so it'd always be like 5, 6, 7 in the morning and he would just price everything at like 5p and would give you free stuff and was the most laid back wonderful man, as if like at night that's night rules.
Night rules. I like the idea that it was 5p but you still weren't willing to pay 5p so he had to give it to you for free. You were saying that your youth means that you don't remember the 70s. It seems very alien to you and very weird to you, because I feel like you're saying about nostalgia. I do feel a nostalgia for things, you know. I'm not really kind of worried about Britishness and the trappings of Britishness, but I am increasingly, as I get older, I do have a fondness for, you know, classic English pint of beer. I do find that I'm beginning to grow an affection for that. And things which I fear are dying out, which seem a loss, like the pipe. it worries me that the, you know, gentleman of yore would smoke a pipe. He would reach perhaps 40, maybe younger, and you would sort of be obligated to take up the pipe. That was what people did. I don't see any young people taking up the pipe.
No one smokes your pipe now. No, but there's a line to be drawn, I think, because sometimes you see someone who's in their 20s smoking a pipe and you think you're doing that for effect.
Of course, and now it's like, you can't
look
do
at
it
me,
now.
I'm a kind of fogey or something. Right. Yeah, I know a lot about Evelyn
Waugh.
You
just want to have it, and you just want to have it as an affectation.
Yeah, exactly. I just want it to be, I want to be able to smoke a pipe.
It's your rite of passage into manhood.
Into adulthood. Mm. I can wear a waistcoat.
I miss smoking jackets.
Smoking, you can put on a jacket to smoke.
Do you know, my granddad used to wear a cravat. I wish I saw more cravats.
Cravats? I mean, the one that really I worry about. My friend always said if he won the lottery and won an awful lot of money, he would campaign tirelessly to bring back the cape as an accessory, because it's such a wonderful item. It's flamboyant, it's sort of, it's dashing, you could arrive at a party with a great flourish. Now it is the sort of thing only worn by Jonathan Ross at a film premiere.
A friend of mine who was, we were doing a benefit together, and the people who were running the charity were talking about the song he'd done last year called Wank Me Off Mrs. Grimshaw, which is a beautiful tale of a child intrigued by the hands of a confectioner.
And again, and, you know, why can't we just sing songs about wanking off people now? Why is it always wanking is seen as a joke? It's ironic. It's a comedy angle. You know, days of yore, you could just talk and sing about wanking, and there was no irony.
Formby.
Well, exactly.
Give me a little stick of Blackpool, rock.
You were talking about wanking off Mrs. Cooper.
Oh, no, Mrs. Grimshaw, yeah, which is by Howard Reed. It's a lovely song. And the person who, one of the people involved in the charity, used to work for a children's charity. And the song isn't about, it's not, you know, kind of paedophilic in any way. And she actually did that line where she went, no, actually, I thought your song was really funny. Not. And you think, well, one, reasonably blunt edge there. And two, well, he hasn't yet agreed to doing the benefit for your charity. So some of these orangutans might die now. And it's just, and I do think that the
and
lack
three,
of passion,
it's not 1991.
Not.
You're not allowed.
Work, does it? Not 1991. Not. No.
I was too serious about that. I'm
can't
sorry.
That.
You can't ask that.
But that might dovetail nicely into the items I've brought, because people who work in the humour industry, as you both do, I don't know what you think of off the shelf humour. You know, there's a lot of comedy items produced that you can buy. Essentially made for people who don't really have a sense of humour, who sort of need to buy them.
They're always so threatening
they're threatening, and they're often grotesque in a way that you couldn't, if you talked about it on stage in a stand-up act, people would be slightly repulsed.
Yeah, like if you went, some of my mates they talk too much, so I've got this chewing gum, what it does is it burns your tongue off.
Right, exactly.
What a bunch of, now they can't talk.
Yeah, and it's a pencil. What you do is you just stick it in his eye. So this is something I brought, which is obviously intended to be humorous, but it seems to have so many elements at work that I was sort of fascinated by it. It's a salt and pepper shaker. I brought this in The Hague. But as you can see, I've an examination of that. It's shaped like a penis. It's salt and pepper shaker, shaped like a penis, but it also is quite carefully detailed in sort of faux paintwork. To suggest, and it is, you know, love from Amsterdam, and there just seems sort of so many things at work, because it's actually quite ornately made.
But it's also quite graphic as a
it's
penis.
It's deeply
got, like,
graphic.
Veins on it
has the veins going on. Obviously, if you shake it as though you were adding salt or pepper, obviously then it appears that you're wanking off this sort of ornately painted.
Well, I'd just be more worried if you were using that salt cellar to kill slugs. The idea to be holding a China penis.
Yes.
And going, do you know what? I love killing slugs. And why
but look
the
at
salt,
it, as you said,
salt doesn't normally have to have two holes, and yet for some reason the one particular detail they've got wrong is by,
yes,
by doubling the hole. Perhaps in a Walter Sickert style of because he had a penile injury. But
it has the painting on it of a windmill. And it has some sort of flowering, as you would expect, maybe just from a vase or something that you might buy in Amsterdam. But no, they've added that. They've kept in the sort of flavour of Amsterdam, but they've added, and essentially what they've done is they've tapped into, and this is what I suppose my point being is that what I found so extraordinary about Holland is the way that the branding of the country is sex. It's like they've
sex
sort of
and
now,
windmills.
Yeah, sex and windmills. They've now just openly embraced the fact that's what they're known for.
Have
on
you
a
finished making
level.
The flower? Yes, I have. Let's have some sex.
Exactly. And so these weren't actually bought in Amsterdam. They were bought in The Hague. So someone has seen them for sale in Amsterdam and thought, well, we've got to sell them in our shop in The Hague because they are so brilliant. And it's
what
just,
kind of a shop was it?
This was just a shop by the seaside. It sold hats. It sold rock. It sold penis-shaped salt shakers.
I think that's shocking, I suppose. But then actually, if you go to seaside shops in the UK, there'll be like, there'll be a bit that's like chocolate willies. Yeah. You go, this is the worst.
But
thing
it's
I've
sort
ever
of
seen.
It just begs so. I mean, I just always think. I think instantly of the people that manufacture them, that work in the factory.
Where are they actually made? Because I don't think they are made in Holland. I'm guessing.
No, hand painted. It says at the bottom, hand painted deco, Holland.
Oh man, that's
so someone has hand painted those China penises.
How's your painting career going? Well, I'm doing something to make money. What are you doing at the moment? Painting on penises.
And then, of course, you've got the people who buy them and then would just have a dinner party and just perhaps, you could just imagine them sniggering before the guests come round, just so excited. We'll just put them on the table. Don't even mention their penises, right? Just wait till Julia. Just wait till Julia. More salt on that, Julia. Let's not put enough salt in the food. Let's just wait. But what I found most extraordinary, and I don't know, I mean, Amsterdam is somewhere that's so kind of being mocked so readily, but until you go there, and I only went recently, I just did not realise how preposterous a place it is. I mean, it's so bizarre. And I walked from the Anne Frank Museum past, literally within seconds, past a shop that in the window was selling, you know, 2-foot leather dildos. Now, I mean, that's a remarkable experience to have, to go from a museum for Anne Frank past a shop selling 2-foot. It just seems sort of inappropriate. You wouldn't, they're so incongruous, those two things. You wouldn't expect to see them. So aside from the fact that they can both reduce a grown man to tears, there's no connection. And it's just I don't know if you've been wrong, but it's one of the creepiest, most sort of depressing places.
Oh, the Anne Frank House is so sad.
No, I don't mean that. I just mean Amsterdam. Yeah. I could go to an Anne Frank House sort of for some light relief, because it's just so, it's such a creepy town. It's a really weird place. And the sex for sale, you know, and people walk through that area, and it's kind of garish and it's kind of overly lit, and it's sort of like if Disney did a sort of, you know, had a red light district in Disneyland, it would sort of feel like it is in Amsterdam. It's brightly lit and there's families walking through it and
yeah,
sort of
like
couples
it's a
holding
fun
hands.
Little
like
day
it's
a
kind
out.
Of let's go and look at the prostitutes.
Yeah. I've got that sounded really vitriolic then. No, I didn't mean, but it was
let's
so
go
scary.
Look at the prozzies. Oh.
All my me and my friends were I think on my like when I was 20, my ex boyfriend organised and we all went. And there were people amongst us who were like, we'll go to a sex show. We've really and there were about 10 of us, and me and I think my friend Alistair were utterly appalled at the idea of having to go, and just sat there with our heads in our hands thinking that I'll never ever forget how awful this was or
absolutely.
Why we were taking it.
Well, and it's weird.
But then we had waffles and they were really good, so it was
swings
all right.
But it's the fact that I think in a sense it sort of brings me full circle to what we were saying about the 70s and sort of England in the 70s, is that despite that sort of creepy sort of prurient, that it's like still a whiff of Victorian attitude towards sex. I sort of quite like the fact that it's behind closed doors and there's something private, and you know, and we should all be slightly ashamed of it. And there's something about sort of Amsterdam and Holland's kind of, you know, openness about sex that can produce, you know.
But you're seeing the garish side, because I would probably imagine there are more. No, what I'm thinking is, I think there are probably more English people who have been to Amsterdam and own penis-shaped condiments of some form or other than the whole pop. You know, no one in Holland has these things. They've almost made, you know, oh, why do the British people come? They come here to snigger and go sex, and so you know, and they just said, well, we might as well make money out of them by hand painting these bits of china.
So. Right, so you feel that these are specifically catering. They've noticed a market for specifically English tourists who crave...
British, I would say, British people who go over there and they think, maybe from some other European countries as well. I think the Dutch probably
Americans.
A little bit more, you know, relaxed.
No, Americans, I don't think Americans would
no,
buy
I
these.
No, I don't think...
They wouldn't buy these.
No, but this is what worries me about these as well, is that when you look at them, you can imagine a woman going... Because it wasn't a specific sex shop you bought it in. You can imagine someone going, oh, look, salt and pepper. They're not looking properly.
Of course.
And they go home and they give
no
them...
No labelling on the box to suggest that.
You give them to your grandchildren. You go, I thought you'd like some salt and pepper. And they go, oh, God. It's like, I want to see this thing.
Look at the box. You would not tell from that picture on the box.
You can't definitely tell. It's kind of a lighthouse thing. Yeah. I had this one experience where in Barnstable, it wasn't Barnstable, it was Coombe Martin when I was about 7. And I thought I'd found some comedy matches. And it said on the front, every player gets ready for. And then almost like they sprung open the big match. And I thought they were just some funny matches that sprung open. Of course, what I didn't realise is the match in the middle, the thing that sprung open, is actually the player's penis.
Of course.
Right.
Of course.
He's getting ready for the big match. And I thought, because my dad smoked cigarettes then, what fun matches. And I still burnt into my head 32 years later, the moment where I went, I thought I bought joke matches, they pop open and show an erect pit. Oh, and that was one of the worst. And so I can imagine that moment when I'm, you know, 9 years old. Dad loves salt. There you go. This is getting ridiculous.
Well,
he bought me the big matches only last year.
Far from putting them on the table to amuse the guests who are coming round, you just proudly put them. Well, we'll be showing off the fact we've been abroad. Let's put our Amsterdam salt and pepper shakers. Oh my God, it's only the vicarage wife, of course.
Josie, sorry, I interrupted you when I was talking about the embarrassment when I bought a box of matches with an image of an erection in it for my dad at the age of 7.
Unfortunately, I can't remember anymore.
Okay, now what have you brought then?
I was thinking about, because at the weekend I did a gig in Dalston, and one of the prizes that we gave out was this box that a friend of mine had found in the charity shop for 99 pence, and it was a handmade wooden box that had been made, you know, nailed together, properly carpentered by someone, and it had this design on the top where it swung open like that, and written on it it said Daniel's inspiration box, and then on one side it said for Daniel to write his thoughts, his ideas, his favorite words, brilliant poems and stories, right? And on the top it said, love you always, Daniel, kiss kiss kiss, right? Someone has given that to a charity shop. Like, how horrible and ungrateful is that? Like, whoever this Daniel is.
So it's Daniel himself who must have handed it in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Daniel. So what happens? Somebody has gone, Daniel, I love you so much, I've made you this gift. And Daniel's gone, cheers, that's going to a charity.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of... And it made me think, like, I just am not going to trust anyone called Daniel anymore. Just
maybe
on principle.
It was... Could it have been a sort of former lover? Everything was fine. But then she started getting a bit clingy.
Maybe she was making them for everyone.
And then he makes one... And
now she would have made
She's made it for him, but he's already trying to get out of the relationship. Maybe some bad memories attached to it.
It just feels
put
so
more
great.
Of your thoughts in another box. I want to keep all your thoughts and don't tell any other girls about your thoughts. Your thoughts are mine. I don't know what to do about this box, lady. Never go out with a small-time
carpenter. But also, it's only valued at 99p as well, which is just so heartbreaking.
They made us write to pen pals when we were doing... Spanish. I was doing Spanish at school, and the girl wrote back, and she'd sort of illustrated it with lots of detail and pictures and flowers, and I was kind of creeped out by it because I was young and I didn't understand that was what girls did, and I just didn't reply.
Aww.
And I, even to this day, I feel racked with guilt that there's a sort of Spanish
look
girl
up
somewhere.
On the Facebook.
Well, I don't remember her name. I kept it for a while, and I would open a drawer, and there it would be haunting
See,
me.
I've had that because two things happened to me. This is what I've brought in is a present, which. Was one of the best presents I'd ever received. It was from a boy I was going out with, and I at the time I wanted to like write stand up, and I was about 16, 17. He made me this thing that says the world's best kept secret, condensed inspiration spelt wrong, which I love spelling mistakes. And then on the back it's sort of got this little fake thing about it, and I loved it, and I've still got it. But this boy totally broke my heart, like ripped it apart, and made me think, you know.
Did you see another one of those on another
girl's
shelves?
Or something. I was around another girl's house and we were, but then I was thinking about how in the past I've made boys things and they haven't necessarily appreciated them, and I just thought it's such a tenuous thing because people don't see. I think if it means a lot to you, it means so much, and then if it doesn't, it's like, well, I'll just put it in the charity.
Well, that's the thing. I think at the happiest moment in your life between two lovers, it is obviously one of the most glorious things, but I think as soon as that sours, if it does, then it just becomes an awful... It's far more intimate than the book they gave you, because it's got their handwriting and it's got their thought in it, and it reminds you of them as a person. I don't want to get depressing, but that's why I never make or give anything to anyone.
Well, once you realise that love is merely a chemical fault in the brain, you might as well just... I mean, that's the trouble, which is one of those cards that Clinton's never did. Love is a chemical fault in the brain. These aren't selling, are they?
I'm not very focused this afternoon, but I'm having a lovely time.
Can you put it on a table and amuse diners?
No, but I can forcibly have sex with people using it.
Oh, hang on, I'm confused. I don't know which one we're talking about now.
I'm just worried that you can also get something, one of those things with a little mustard spoon in it, made like a vagina as well. Anyway, I will just leave you with another advert that I didn't read to you from Man's World from the early 70s. Be a man. Get a man's job. Operating heavy equipment. Cranes, drag lines, clamshells, scrapers, hydraulic backhoes. Those are the kind of jobs available, if you know.
That's the kind of thing that Jeremy Kyle would say now.
This is I'll read this next time. Far out bedroom practices of women's lib, inverted commas. Wow. We'll be covering all those things. Thank you very much to Steve Merchant. Thank you very much to Josie Long.
Thanks for having me.
That's it. Did you buy anything else in Holland?